Okay, so yesterday we said briefly that the Mishnah with a lowercase m, Torah Shebaal Peh, existed for Moshe Rabbeinu's time, was passed on orally from Rebbe to Talmud, from Moshe down until it was redefined as a set text, or at least a set of teachings in the Mishnah. I want to show you the two most basic sources for how this happened and what went on, from Rashi and from the Rambam. Rashi precedes the Rambam by 100 years, a good 100 years, believe it or not. And Rashi also has a different tradition than the Rambam, because Rashi was already a student of the Chachmei Ashkenaz. Rashi lived in France and Germany. The Rambam lived in Spain and Fez and Egypt, and he has a bit of a different tradition. You'll see that they're not in great dispute, but they just come from different places. I'm recording. In any case, I want you to see these two super fundamental sources inside, because we're not going to commence this without that. So that's what we're holding. So to start, I want to run a Gemara with you. You have, grab a source sheet over here. Sit wherever you want. Grab a source sheet. Okay, so I made a big effort. I got your translation in English of Rashi. Okay? And I've got you, which we'll get there in a minute. And you'll see there's sort of three arrows on the Hebrew side, 1, 2, and 3. And it's hopefully sort of annotated in English, clearly, where 1, 2, and 3 are, so everyone can follow along, whether in Hebrew or in English. We start with the Gemara itself. So number point one, there's an arrow there, Tana Rabbanan. This is Gemara above Metzia. It's just a standalone Gemara talking about prioritization and learning. So the Gemara, as you read it, we'll read it first, just straightforward without any commentary. You'll see that the Gemara seems to be the greatest piece of pro-Mishnah propaganda you'll ever come across. It reads like this: Tana Rabbanan, the rabbis taught, so that's a braisa. Ha'oskin b'mikra, one who, grab yourself a source sheet. Good morning, grab yourself a source sheet. If you haven't signed in or yesterday, please do, because we're going to figure out a WhatsApp group and an email list and all that kind of business. So grab a, make sure you're on the sign-in sheet there. Even if you're on the sign-in sheet from last time around, re-sign in. Okay, so here's again. And remind me to take a photograph at the end so we can look at ourselves in 5 years' time. So, yeah, so source number one begins the Gemara itself above the Metzia. It says, Tana Rabbanan, the rabbis taught a brais ha'oskim b'mikra. If one studies mikra, I told you yesterday, is the 24 books of the Tanakh, one who basically learns psukim, just reads the psukim inside, like a Tanakh, Koran Tanakh type thing. So then, mida, that's significant, but ve'ena mida, but not really all that significant. Rashi says hiktsas. It's a little bit. Rabbeinu Chananel, who I didn't copy here, explains, not like Rashi, as we'll see in a minute, but Rabbeinu Chananel explains what you think it would mean, which is, if you just read the psukim, you don't know what they're talking about. You don't understand the actual how to fulfill the mitzvah, so it's sort of limited in value. The Gemara goes on to say, remember, as I told you yesterday, that the Chazal looked at the Torah as three categories. There's Mikra, Mishnah, and Gemara. So now we're going to go to the second part. The Mishnah, if a person studies Mishnah, that's Mida, that is significant. The Notna Leaschar, and the person who studies Mishnah, again, this is Mishnah with a lowercase m, meaning the Mishnayos that were taught, Rebbe to Talmud, Brisas. You'll see in a moment, the Gemara itself will refer to this Brisa as Mishnah. So you'll see what it means in a second. So those who study Mishnah, meaning Torah Shebaal Peh, so that's also Mida, that's also significant. The Notna Leaschar, and the person gets reward for that. But Gemara, if a person is involved in Gemara, as I described yesterday, and Rashi will also explain further, but the thinking about the Mishnayos and their implications and how they compare one to the other, so then that, Ein lecha mida gedola mezu, there's nothing more significant than that. And then the Gemara says, Ola olam, and sort of nevertheless, if you will, whatever the case may be, grab a source sheet right over here. La'olam, have you rats la Mishnah? Yosem in a Gemara. Nevertheless, even though there's nothing greater than learning Gemara, you should, and again here, Gemara doesn't mean the Gemara text as we have it. This precedes, this Bryce was written in the year, let's pretend the year 200, that kind of, that, you know, 180, whatever it is, way before the Gemara was codified and, you know, hundreds of years later. But if a person is involved in the consideration and analysis of the Mishnayos that he learns, that's the greatest. And nevertheless, la'olam, person should always, lolo means something like always. Your priority two, la'olam, have you rats the Mishnah? You should run to learn Mishnah. Yosem in a Gemara. More than learning Gemara. So this Gemara, as the Gemara itself will object, is obviously self-contradictory, because the first thing we said was, yeah, Psukim, they're okay, but Mishnah's good, Gemara's great, but learn Mishnah, so it doesn't quite add up. Fine. The Pasha Pshat here, as you would think, before we see Rashi, is that the reason why Mishnah is good but not great is that the Gemara is sort of taking it to the next level, and yet Mishnah presumably gets priority because you don't have the basics, you can't appreciate it, taking it to the next level. That's the Pashas, that's how Rabbeinu Hanana learned, etc., in short, but not how Rashi learns, you'll see in a little bit. In any case, the Gemara, I want to say the Gemara inside first, the Gemara says ha-gufa-kasha. The Gemara says the whole thing doesn't make any sense. Ha-gufa-kasha means this is internally inconsistent. Gufa, the thing itself, contradict, is difficult. It doesn't make sense. Amart b'gemara, en lecha mina gedola mezu. First thing you said, the Gemara objects, in the Braisa, the first thing the Braisa said was, there's nothing greater than learning Gemara. And then it says, v'hadar, like sort of backtracked, v'amart, and it said, ula olam havirat v'mishna, yosem in a Gemara. You should learn Mishnah. Now, yoser doesn't mean, I might have said before. It doesn't mean before in order. It means yoser, meaning higher priority. You should rather, better, always, in prioritization, run to learn Mishnah more than learning Gemara. It doesn't make sense. So, I'm Rabbi Yochanan. Now, Rabbi Yochanan is going to answer the steer, the contradiction. Rabbi Yochanan, just to get to sort of know, this is quite important historically for this particular Gemara. Rabbi Yochanan was actually a Talmud of Rabbi Yud Nasi. He was very young, and he's considered really a second generation Amora, because the first generation of Amoraim and Eretz Yisrael were very brief. But Rabbi Yochanan really becomes he's the one who began the Talmud Yerushalmi, and he's the one who was like the Gadol Dor in his generation, who really is the one who developed the proper study of Mishnah, as you could say. And perhaps he's the one who wrote them down, perhaps. Whatever the case, Rabbi Yochanan says, no. So now I'm going now, skipping down. This is very confusing. Now look at the two, the arrow of the two. That's just the next Amud of Gemara. I photocopied it, and I scanned it. I cut out, you know, the Tosos and stuff. So now it's part number two, just the next page. Chavon Tzia, Lamed Gimel, and Beis. Bimei Rebbe Nishnas Mishnazu. Rabbi Yochanan says that this Braisa, the Tanur Rabbanan, that says Mishnah is nice, Gemara is better, but learn Mishnah, this was written in the days of Rebbe Yehud Nasi, in other words, the one who wrote the Mishnah. See how it's calling itself a Mishnah, but it's a Braisa, but so that's Rabbi Yochanan's explanation. And in that time, I'll show you Rashi in a second, but I'm explaining according to Rashi now. In that time, Shavku Kule Alma, Masnisin, everyone abandoned the study of what I'll translate as Braisos for a second. Everyone stopped studying the tradition that was passed down because Rebbe stopped memorizing because Rebbe sort of collected everyone. Va'azlu basar gemara, and they all spent their time figuring out how to reconcile the different traditions and how to, which should be in and out, what the halacha was like. So in that generation, everyone abandoned their, like I'll call it memorization, their focus on what I'll now call Torah Shebaal Peh, and focused instead in the third part on Gemara, which was the order of the day and necessary. But the problem was then, as we'll see in Rashi in a minute, people then started to not focus on their Mishnah learning, and therefore they were likely to forget it, and therefore the Gemara backtracks and says, since Shavka Kula Alma, everyone had gone and abandoned Masnis and their learning of the Torah Shebaal Peh, va'az the Basar Gemara, and focused on the Gemara part of it. Hadar Vadarsh, so then there's a backtracking, and Rebbe taught Lahu to his students, Ula Olam Havi Ratz La Mishnah Yosem in a Gemara. No, you first need to go back to your Mishnah learning, lest you forget your Mishnah learning, then the Gemara won't be useful to you. So, as we'll see, and we'll stop there. So now I want to show you a few Rashis. Okay, that's the Rashis are important. I don't know if I want to show all the Rashis, but I want to show you. First, let me speak it outside before I get bogged down with a lot of words in Rashi. According to Rashi, therefore, what we're saying here is actually not what it looks on face value. What it looks like on face value is the Mishnah is the greatest thing ever, even though Gemara might have more schar, let's say, but Mishnah is higher in priority. Rashi puts a spin on it. He says that's because in this day and age, when this is written, people were likely to forget the Torah Shebaal Peh, which might mean, perhaps, that in nowadays, when we have the Torah Shebaal Peh, the Mishnah is written down, because Rashi is going to learn that the Mishnah wasn't written down in Rebbe's time. It's remained oral, so you could still forget it. But maybe, perhaps, one could argue that Bizman Azeh, nowadays, since now it's definitely written down. No one's going to forget the mission anymore. Gemara would retake preference, and sort of this would, that would supersede this Gemara, perhaps. Perhaps. The spirit of the Gemara would remain. That Rashi is saying, in the time that this Bryce was written, which is the, we'll call it the beginning of the Marai period. Yes, I'm recording. There was no Mishnah written down. Even though Rebbe had formalized and codified the Mishnah as a set of teachings, Rashi, unlike the Rambam, learned that there was stayed oral. So you might forget it. So Rashi says that what the sentiment of this Braisa is people better not forget their Mishnah, focus on learning their Mishnayos, or they'll forget them, and then it's lost. You can't reclaim it because it wasn't written down yet. So I'm now suggesting that perhaps one could argue that despite how on the face of it this Braisa looks like the world's greatest piece of pro-Mishnah propaganda, it might be less impactful, Bizman Hazeh, according to Rashi, when the Mishnayos are written down. No one's going to forget the Mishnayos anymore. So perhaps one could argue that the study of Gemara now supersedes La'olam Habirat's the Gemara. One might think. It's not clear from here. This Gemara is not La'halacha, and it's a little ambiguous. The sentiment I would think, even according to Rashi, is clear that the Mishnayos are essential, you know, grist for the mill, that the material you need to generate Gemara. But maybe it is not as important anymore. Maybe that's a Rashi held. Rashi learns that Mishnah learning is really now fully second string to Gemara. There are a few Rashi that are very important. The most important Rashi is the big one. Let's focus on that one. So if you skip to 3, and it's now, you see I translated 3 on the back. That's an effort here. So there's a big effort to translate the Rashi here. So if you can't follow in Hebrew, follow in English, that's fine. I'm going to go through it in Hebrew here. This little Rashi comment, which is quite a long Rashi, is Rashi's presentation, so to speak, of what I told you yesterday. So I want you to see it inside. It's important. So the Mishnah, the Gemara had said, the Bimei Rebbe Nishnas Mishnah Zu, that the what it's calling a Mishnah, which is really the Baraisa, Mishnah with a lowercase m, was taught in the time of Rebbe Yehuda Nasi, and the transition was happening as I just described. But look inside. Hadakatani Gemara, when the Baraisa taught us that Gemara, when it comes to the learning and considering, the thinking about the Torah Shebaal Peh, in the Chamida Gedola Mizu, there's no greater, nothing more significant than that. Lefi she Mishirabu Talmidich, because Mishirabu Talmidich Shammai VeHillel, when the students of Shammai and Hillel's two sort of schools became more numerous, V'hai Lefan of Shlosha Doros, and that already is now 3 generations are passing. As a comment, I don't know what Rashi means by 3 generations. I don't know what he means by that exactly. For the record, Hillel was the Nasi. Hillel's son, Shimon, became the next Nasi. Then Shimon's son, Gamliel, became the next. I don't want to get bogged down by this, but it's just a simple there's a lot of, in case you, I'm sure you realize a lot of Shimon and Gamliel talking about. What happens is Hillel, okay, so Hillel lived around 0, a little earlier, but call it 0 if you want to keep in mind. Clear? The common era. So Hillel actually originally came from Babel. He came to Israel to learn. Famous. He became the Nazi. Long story short. Hillel, for what it's worth, didn't come through David Melch from his mother's side, from his father's side rather than his mother's side. This is a bit of tension. Chachmei Eretz Yisrael, Chachmei Baba, if Hillel was legitimate to be Nasi, the real Jewish people, because he didn't send the daughter of his father's line. And that's how this whole line is what it is. So Hillel has, his son is Shimon. Hillel. That son is Gamliel. His son is Shimon. His son is Gamliel. That's very fast here. His son is Shimon again. And this over here is Rebbe. Rebbe. Now, I don't know. So I don't know what Rashi means exactly by 3 generations. That's what it means. It could be that these were shortest generations. This is, let's call it around the year 0 to 4. And this is around
is around the year zero. And this is around the year, I think it came like around 180. Whatever it is. Oh, sorry, it came a little earlier, but whatever. 188 says it's not right. In any case, I don't know what Rashi meant three generations. I'm not sure what he has in order. But it doesn't really matter. For what it's worth, this is, the Rabban Gamliel. This is the Chorban. Okay, so the famous Rabban Gamliel who, of Yavna, who was, you know, there was, he was the one, famous Morrison brought us that he followed Rabbi Yeshua and they eventually kicked him off the stage and put Lazar Azariah into place. One of the stories. This is Rabbi Gamliel here. I want to mention for a second, he's very important in this context here. Ever knows that Gemara? This Gemara Brachas, famous Gemara Brachas, Chavches 28, that says that Rabbi Gamliel, when he set up shop in Yavna, Yavna was the place that his head removed after the Korban. So he a number of times was very, call it intolerant of competing opinions. There are three different episodes in Shas where he basically sticks in his heels and forces Rabbi Yeshua, who was a greater scholar, to sort of submit to Rabbi Gamliel's opinion. And in any case, it happened three times. Probably the most famous one is Rosh Hashanah, where he had to come with his walking stick on his Yom Kippur. That story is really familiar. And money. And he kissed Rabbi Gamliel, kissed Rabbi Yeshua, and said, called him his son as a teacher. His teacher is a greater, but his son in terms of Rabbi Yeshua was Machni himself. Himself for Rabbi Gamliel. The third time, most famous, was that the students rebelled. They said they felt Rabbi Gamliel had disrespected Rabbi Yeshua, gone too far and too many times. Basically, kicked him out. They sort of kicked him out and they deposed him as the Nasi. They put him like an outsider. This was a lie. Shell him down. They put him in here temporarily, Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah. Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, it didn't matter. He was brought in as a child, 18 according to Bavli, 16 according to Yishami. He's the one that you have. We'll see in Rachos very soon. He's the one from his peasant Haggadah who says, Hari Ani Kibben Shim Shana. I'm like 70. He was a child of 18 or 16. He had a miracle with his beer went overnight. That's the story here. It went white over this episode. In any case, so Rabbi Gamliel, who was sort of putting his foot down and being intolerant of other opinions, I want to explain what's going on up there. It's a longer discussion because it's not our topic for today. But he was addressing the problem which Rashi is lamenting in our Gemara here. The problem was that back in these good old days here, Hillel and Shammai had two schools. There was a lot of competing opinions, and it became, as Rashi will quote the Gemara in heaven, and it became as if there were two different Torahs. There was the Torah got very split. So Rabbi Gamliel's opinion, I'm putting words in his mouth here, forgive me, was that maybe in the good old days when we were sovereign. Our own big possession, we have sort of quasi autonomy, so we can afford the luxury of having disputes of such scope. But Rabbi Gamliel felt after the Korban that really no way. The Jewish people have lost the basement Mikdash, were sort of really on the thumb of the Romans and were under tremendous pressure. And we don't sort of like around the wagons, circle the wagons, kind of come together, really, we're gonna be lost, really. So he really felt that you can't tolerate this approach of having multiple streams of, I'll call it, Jewish practice, we can't have any more. We have to really unify once again. That's why he had sort of ruled like an iron fist, and he, I guess, argued took it too far. But that's this generation over here. This Shimon Gamliel over here, I'm nervous that I was wrong. This Shimon over here is also featured in the first paragraph of Brachos. He's one who says, not everyone who loves color roots and litos and shed yitzel, not everyone can live up to Rabbi Gamliel's high standards. We'll see about. I'll remind you later on. But anyways, he's featured prominently in that. Okay. So this I was looking at it. It sure feels like a lot.
Yeah, not for 100 years.
Oh, that's sure. Okay, that's my memory. I didn't like re-review this. But my whole memory serves as well. I think it's okay. I think it's right.
I'll check it up myself and I'll come back tomorrow with my tail between my leg if I got it wrong.
Correct it.
I think that's right. In any case, my point is, I don't know what Rashi means by three generations. I'm not sure exactly what he means by that. I don't know. In any case, Shai Lefana Shlosha Doros, Rab Machlokas, for three generations, which is, however it is, it's for long, a number of generations, there was an expanse, an increase in fighting, you know, Machlokas, disagreements about how the Torah Shlofe is, but Torah, Vanaz Kishtei Toros, and it became as if there were two competing Torahs, Chas V'Shalom, as if it were. That's a quote from a Gemara in Sanhedrin. Umetoch ol shibun malchios, and because of the oppression, it was the Roman oppression, ugezeros, and there were a number of gezeros, I think, I don't know, there were numerous ongoing gezeros, but the Hadrianic ones were the worst, but in any case, like I told you yesterday, under Domitian, under Quietus, there were also gezeros. Shahayu gozun alehen, umetoch kach, they were, because of the burden there, lohayu chon l'ses lev, they didn't have the ability to apply themselves, literally to, you know, to lay. I'm going to stick my heels in the ground here. The word lave throughout Kol Torah Kula, at least in rabbinic literature, we'll call it, means mind. Heart is a silly way to translate it. They never, they weren't able to apply their mind. Levarer divrei hachokim, to, yeah, sim lev, to pay attention. Yeah, that's the modern Hebrew for this. But anyways, yeah. So they weren't able to apply their minds to be mevarer, to clarify. Like Bora, you know, to separate the chaff from the ochel on the right. Divrei hachokim, to clarify when there's two competing opinions, things are arguing, to clarify who was right and who was wrong. Ad yamav shel Rebbe, until we reach the days of Rebbe, Rehud Nasi, shenasana kadosh baruch lo chein be'eni antoninus. Kadosh baruch hu Hashem gave, blessed Rebbe Yehuda Nasi with the, you know, with, he found favor in the eyes of Antoninus. Again, Antoninus Lachora is Marcus Aurelius Antoninus. Melech Romi, the Roman Emperor. Kedamrinan and Bavadazar, there's a story in Bavadazar, fine. Vanachu Mitzara, and they got like a respite from the oppression. Vashalach Vakabatz Kol Talmidei Eretz Yisrael. So Rebbe Yehuda Nasi sent for and gathered together all the Chachamim of his generation, the last generation of Tanaim. Until his time, until the days of Rebbe, there was no order to the Mesechtos like we have them today. There was no such thing. Everyone just was a student, and he heard from his teacher, who was greater than him. They would just sort of memorize it, and then sort of mentally annotate where it came from. Halacha plonus, uplonus, shematim b'shem ploni. They would say, oh, I know this rule, and I heard it from this halacha, I heard it from this Rebbe, and this halacha, I heard from that Rebbe, and that's, the Gemara is replete with that. Amar Rebbe, Yehuda Amar Rav, or whatever the story is. That's how the whole Masorah is passed on. And of course, most people had a single Rebbe, so then of course everything becomes from their Rebbe. But the point is, everything is sort of memorized and said over, but no overarching Seder, no overarching organization to these halachas at all, according to Rashi. Ukshas Kabsu, when they got together, all those men that Rebbe Yehuda Nasi had gathered, Amakolechad Masha Shama, everyone said over what they had heard from their tradition. Vanasnu Leiv, they all then, now, as a collective, apply themselves. Levarer Tamei Amachlokas, to figure out what was a Machlokas in each of these different discrepant traditions. Divrei Mi Ru'uyin L'Kayim, and to figure out who was the right opinion to keep as a halacha. Visidru Mesechtos, and he ordered, this is Rebbe, and I guess the Beis Din, they ordered the Masechta that we have them today. Divrei Nezikin Levadam, Nezikin to its Masechta, for what it's worth, we don't have a Masechta's Nezikin. We have Bava Kama, Bava Masid, Bava Basra, but actually it was originally Masechta's Nezikin, which then, Bava means like gates, so Bava Kama, the first third, Bava Matsiya, the second third, and Bava Basra, the final third, because Nezikin's 30 prokem, it's too big. But anyway, that's what he's referring to. And Divrei Yevamos Levadam, Yevamos, so to speak, as he's illustrating the point, kept totally separate in a new Masechta, but Divrei Kadshim Levadam and the halachas of Kadshim. I don't know why it says Yevamos, to be honest, but anyways, he's dividing, you know, tort law and the Zikin and the Nashim, you know, marital law, let's call it, in Yevamos, and Kadshim, another Seder to itself, Levadam, Altotone. Fine. Vesasam Nami B'mishnah, Divrei Yechidim, Shara Rebbe Es Divreihem. This is hard to translate literally, how what it means figuratively, and I'll go back to the words inside, is Rebbe cut out the names of individual opinions. He didn't want it to, if the halacha in Rebbe's view, in his Bez's view, was the halacha in the proper way, he removed the particular attribution. He didn't say, this is what Rebbe Akiva said. Because by saying this is what Rebbe Akiva said, it would imply, but others disagree. He said, no, we want unity, and therefore he just said, this is how it is. So that's, he cut out the actual citation of who the Masorah came from. That's what he's saying here. Again, sasam means like to anonymize. I don't know the word in English for that. So sterilize, to take out the source. So so sasam, v'sasam nami b'mishnah, v'sasam nami b'mishnah divrei yechidim, the, anonymized the, in the Mishnah, the opinions of individual persons, shara Rebbe es divrehem, that Rebbe sort of saw that, agreed with their opinions as the Bezin. Vishnan stam kadelik, and he taught it as a stam, just as a like anonymous opinion, kadelik bo halacha kamosam, to tell you this is how the halacha is. So that's the stam Mishnah, Rebbe's opinion is that's the halacha. Lafikach amr ba gemara, ein lach amida gadola mezu. Now Rashi, now he's explaining the gemara. He says, this is why there's nothing greater than learning Mishnayas, she yitnu lev latamei Mishnah. Because we have to figure out the ration. The greatest thing is to figure out the reasons and the rationales and the opinions behind the Mishnah. But then look at the next Rashi. I don't have it in English. I'm sorry, but he wrote, read this next. Shavku kulit. We explain why, even though Talmud is the greatest, but Mishnah gets priority. This is the Rashi in Hebrew. Shavku kuliyam masnisin. Everyone abandoned their Mishnah, meaning malachso agirsas mishnasan. They stopped rehearsing by memory what they learned in their tradition. And as the basa gemara, Neil went after the gemara, lachshav b'svara, to think about, think about these contents. And therefore, hadar darsh lu havi ratz the Mishnah, and therefore he retracted the fishe yira, he was afraid, pen yishka yishtachachu, lest it be forgotten, hamishnayos, all over again, v'yachlifu shemos hachacham, and the names get mixed up, v'mkom chi of yomru pator, and when something was chayav, they would mistakenly remember it to be pater, v'makum asar yom ramoter. Again, they make mistakes in the dinam, the basic dinam, because they get too bogged down with the Gemara. And therefore, here are Mishnah's, the Gemara here is saying, this Brisa is saying, so that shouldn't happen, so people shouldn't now just focus on Gemara learning exclusively and forget the actual contents of the Mishnah, which the Mishnah Torshal Peh has the content, as opposed to thinking about it, we re-emphasize, you've got to get the content clear first. Fine, that is an, the reason I bring this in here is, most important to see Rashi's approach to the whole thing. It's an important Rashi. This isn't the halacha. I'm going to show you Bez Hashem tomorrow how it comes out the halacha. This about in terms of where Mishnah fits into prioritization. This Gemara tended to say the prioritization of learning, but it ends up getting pushed away because Rabbi Yochanan says this Mishnah only applied in those, this whatever is being prioritized here. The application is only relevant to Rebbe's generation. It wouldn't be to subsequent generations. There's another Gemara in Kedushin we'll see tomorrow, Bez Hashem, which actually is the one that filters down the halacha about prioritization of learning and how to divide up your learning. What I do want to do, however, today, is learn the Rambam's version of this story here. This is quite famous. I assume many people have seen it before. Another arts and crafts job on my part this morning. So, here you are. I did it with kudos for those who want in Hebrew. I did it in English for those who want. English. Sorry? This is actually the translation you have to do is Beryl Wine's translation. Rabbi Beryl Wine did it in his book. I just basically cut him. I just changed the spelling of Rebbe from R-E-B-I to R-E-B-B-I because I couldn't look at it. So now, what are you looking at here? What I showed you before is Rashi. Rashi is, I told you what it's worth, born in 1040 and lived in today is modern-day Germany and France, that had that Ashkenazi tradition from Rabbeinu Gershom and so. This is the Rambam. The Rambam's, this is introduction to his Yad HaChazaka, the Rambam and his master work, the Mishnah Torah. He gives how it came to be what he's writing, the Mishnah Torah, starting from Moshe Rabbeinu on down. He famously sort of names each generation, who they were and who passed it on to whom. And in the story of how it got passed down, there's a big interruption, of course, because the first half of the story is an oral transmission, and then all of a sudden things get written down. So he stops in his listing to let you know how that happened. And that's our story, our Mishnah story. So this is the middle of the introduction to the Rambam, the introduction to the Yad HaChazaka. Really, if you haven't read it before, I mean, the whole introduction, it's very short. This is like more than 10% of it already right here in front of you. You should go and read it. Really, you should read it and learn it. It's just basic, sort of basic Judaism 101. It's like, whatever, you got to read it. In any case, this is the part that where he introduces the concept of Mishnah. So here is what he says. This is the Rava. Rabbeinu HaKadosh Chibor HaMishnah. Now, Chibor, Lechor, means to write. So right away, so the Rambam is consigned to being of a sheet that Rabbi Nasi wrote down the Mishnayos, as we call Mishnah, as opposed to Rashi. See, Rashi right away was saying, even in Rabbi Yochanan's generation, Rabbi's generation, we're going to forget the Mishnah because it wasn't written down. So that is according to the tradition of Shiragon. Now, Shiragon, just basic, you know, let me say this once now. It's a little topic, but it's so, if this isn't clear, then many things will be unclear later on. So we talked about yesterday how we have basically 1,000 years from Moshe Rabbeinu down to the end of to the Arche Knesset Gedola. That's the time of prophecy, 1,000 years. Okay, then you have 500 years of we'll call it Bayashani time. Basically, look, it's hard to say exactly when the Tanaim start that period exactly. Sometimes called beginning Arche Knesset Gedola, which had the last of the prophets, and then it talks about something the period of the Zugos, the pairs. Okay. There were 5 pairs of Zugos. The last of the Zugos was Hillel and Shammai. So that this becomes these are the Nisim, this line over here, the Nisim, the heads of the Jewish people, once for sure that the Tanaim begins. So after Hillel, everyone Tana, that's for sure. Tana means teachers. And that went on from, let's if we say Hillel is 0, that went on to the year, let's call it 200, be round. So that's 200 years of Tanaim for sure. In the year 200, the Tanaim period ends, the Mishnaic period ends, and now the next, we'll call it 300 years, is the period of the Amoraim, the year 500, obviously round numbers, close to a century for the sake of clarity. Okay, for reasons I don't get into this second, but after the year 500, the Talmud is written down, Ravina and Ravashi, and that ushers in a new time of Jewish learning. The West was a mess, and therefore Jewish living was only the really Jewish civilization, cultural, intellectual civilization, really was happening only in Babel. Okay, that was where the action was at. Babel, amazingly, had been set up near, let's call it like 597 BCE. Like, you know, and before the Korban of the First Bias, like when Yechezkel and so were sent out in exile 13 years before the Korban, they set up shop in Babel. So Babel was many times competing as a place of leadership for Judaism, relative to Eretz Yisrael. Very famously, when Ezra came back, beginning of the Arche Knesset Gedola period, virtually no one came with him. He came on his own, and who we found left behind were pretty poor as far as Jews go, Samaritans, and so. In any case, there was a conflict where who got priority. I alluded to that a minute ago when I said that Hillel was looked at as only from his mother's side, from David HaMelech. So there was like a tension. In any case, in the time of Rebbe Nasi, for sure, Eretz Yisrael was where it's at, and you'll see that, at least one thing you'll note, every time you see the word Rebbe mentioned in the Gemara, that's only people from Eretz Yisrael. That means they have smicha, but you only could get smicha in Eretz Yisrael. So they certainly had, clearly, you know, everyone recognized Eretz Yisrael as Eretz HaKodesh, and that gave them sort of pride of place for the time being. After Rebbe died, things really devolved terribly. Jewish life was rough. Christians were also rough, and they were giving a hard time. But the Roman Empire became destabilized. And the grandson of Rebbe Nasi was named Rebbe Yehuda Nasiya. Lots of Yehudas, it's confusing. Rebbe Yehuda Nasiya was the last of like the semblance of stability in Eretz Israel. After that, the Roman Empire basically fell apart. I think there were 18 emperors in 50 years. So it was a nightmare. And what happened is Rav, who was a student of Rebbe Yehuda Nasi, Rav was a leading student of his, and he was young. There's a Gemara in Brachas, if you remember, Rebbe Yehuda Nasi was sitting at a table with Rav Chia, who I think is maybe his uncle, or nephew, I forgot which, and or just a cousin. Maybe Rebbe Chia was a cousin of Rebbe. And then his son or nephew, Rav, at the table, and he says, Rebbe said to Rav, go wash your hands, and Rav panicked, and he said, oh no, he's just telling you to lead the benching, if you remember that famous, quite an interesting Gemara. The point was that Rav was very young, but Rebbe recognized him as sort of like the upcoming Gadol Hador. That's the story over there. So Rav, after in around the year 220, something like that, picked up and left Eretz Yisrael, moved to Bavel, didn't want to step on Shmuel's toes over there, because Shmuel was the existing Gadol Hador. Shmuel was in Narda. So Rav moved to a place called the Masa Machzia, which is also known as Sura, and set up a second yeshiva, which became the great yeshiva of Sura for the next 1,000 years. So when that happened, when Rav shifted over to move from Eretz Yisrael to Bavel, basically that was the end of Eretz Yisrael in terms of primacy of Torah learning. So then Bavel became leading place. There was some competition from Eretz Yisrael, but it was really secondary. Certain things you can't do outside of Eretz Yisrael. So Eretz Yisrael, of course, was Eretz Yisrael, but because the Christians and, you know, Council of Nicaea, and so it was very rough in Eretz Yisrael to be a Jew. Life flourished in Bavel. And that's what the Bavli happens. How the Bavli happens. The year, let's call it 500, it finishes. For the next 500 years, from the year 500 CE to the year 1038 of the Common Era, everything outside of Bavel is pretty much a wasteland, a Jewish wasteland, a backwater. There were Jews all over the place, don't get me wrong. Like, Bezman HaZeh, there are Jews in all sorts of far-flung cities. But like, you know, they were like way out-of-towners. Jewish life was headed in Bavel. And the leaders of the Babylonian community, there was a Rosh Yeshiva, were called Gaonim. Gaon, the word Gaon meant the head of the yeshiva, and actually it was chosen, perhaps, because Gaon is Gematria 60, and there are 60 Masechtas in the Shas. So the point was the Gaon had mastery of the whole thing. It was the Gaon. And the Torah literature of that the Gaonic period is basically Shas and Shuvas. So there are many, many Shas and Shuvas from Shrier Gaon or High Gaon and so on. They were the last two of the Gaonim. So that was where Jewish life was at. So there's really that 600 years in Bavel divided into two parts. The first part is called the Rabbanan Savarai. Savarai from Ritzvar, like the, I don't know, considerers, doesn't translate literally, the thinkers. There's not much known about them, but they ended up editing the Talmud more. Okay, so the Gemara got after Rabbeinu and Rashi closed the Gemara, it got some heavy duty, like century long editorial work done to it. It's not clear exactly what they did or didn't do, but many times you'll see like commentaries and showing, oh, this can't be from originally, it must have been added later on and so on. This is, I'm sure there's mountains of scholarship done on it, but not in traditional Orthodox Jewish scholarship. Just no one really cares that much, I don't think. Sorry? Yeah, I'm sure if you go to Harvard and Judaic Studies, there are plenty of people who have done their PhDs on these. There's lots to be said, and you find artifacts, there's Genesis. But they seem to have, Rabbanan Savarai, whatever impact they had on the Gemara, which I think is significant, we don't know about it. That's sort of hidden, brushed on the carpet. It was just not annotated what they did. And whatever, they're sort of forgotten. I don't think you 100 Jews could name, I couldn't name anyone, any name that belongs to that period. I don't know. In any case, the second half Gaonim were quite famous, and there are letters. Shas and Tshuvas are extant. We have them. The last of them are of Rav Shira and Rav Hai Gaon, and that ends the year 138. I don't know how I get into all this history so much now. Around the same, I'll just take a half a back step back. It's worth understanding what the Gemara is going on here. Originally, in the time of Rebbe, I told you yesterday how how Antoninus Marcus Aurelius had come across to fight the Parthians. The Parthians were sort of like barbaric from the Roman perspective anyways. And they were a mix, they weren't so great as the Jews. But their replacements, also around the year that Rav came, basically, as Hashem arranged it, were Zoroastrians, the Sassanid Empire, and they were pretty well disposed to Jews. And that was part of it. The Jews really had it good under them. They're famous. They had this they worshipped like Zoroastrianism. There's still Zoroastrians around today. And Iran, they have a very, really rough time, so they really run from Iran if they can. They're really persecuted in Iran today. But there's Zoroastrians around. So Zoroastrians, they argue, if you meet a Zoroastrian, they will tell you they're the first monotheists, just like Hindus will tell you they're also the first monotheists. But Zoroastrianism, really, they've got two gods they really worship. And if you will, there's like the good god and the bad god, or the god of light and the god of darkness, whatever. That is what the Christian notion of Satan comes from. It's a competing force. The Christian version of Satan is really because of Zoroastrian influence. This competing force. I don't get into that now at all. But I did want to tell you, you see that there's weird Gemaras. You see, for example, like talk about how you can't, like if you're afraid of the people coming to get you, can extinguish your fire on Shabbos, or like, you know, they can, what if it's dangerous to light your Hanukkah candles outside, you can light it inside and so on. The reason was they reserved lighting fire for their religious service of their god of light, whatever it was. And so in certain of their holidays, no one could have light except for the temples and so on. But anyways, you see this cropping up a lot of times. They're called chavirai. It looks like chavirai. I don't know the actual proper pronunciation of that word. But you see these nasty, you see from time to time these nasty leaders of the Zoroastrians, Sassanid Empire, that were really terrible to the Jews, Chavarai. I'll show you in tomorrow's if it comes to them. In any case, so life was good under that until 1038, then the Muslims came into town and all went to pot. The Jews were basically rammed to lies from Babel, and then there basically were two separate, that was the end of the Goni period, 1038. It's a pretty hard date. After that, there's basically two Jewish communities. There's the Jewish communities that fled from Babel and stuck around these regions, what became the Sephardic regions, right? And they become Sephardim, but it included Babylonia, Egypt, Turkey, and up to Spain. And they were the greater of the two. The other community ended up in Europe, which was a super backwater. Europe was like nowhere, undeveloped, really undeveloped, and still in like the Dark Ages. And Jews set up shop over there, but much fewer. So there's the Rishonim, that begins the period of the Rishonim. There are two different streams of Judaism that stream come out of that. There's the Ashkenazi Jewry. Ashkenaz is like modern-day Germany and France. And then there's Sephardic, which literally means Spain, but that's only, they got the name because that's where they ended up later on. Spain was good for the Jews, but in the beginning they started all over. In any case, those are two, since there wasn't that much, for the next 500 years, roughly, 400 whatever years, there was no printing press, okay? And there was a lot of tension between the Christian world, which is the Ashkenaz side of things, and the Muslim world, which was the Sephardic side of things. Probably more useful, actually, to think of it not as geography, but as cultural, that the Ashkenazi Jewry were under Christian rule and the Sephardic Jewry were under Muslim rule. That's probably a more useful way of thinking of it. And they diverge. In any case, Rashi, who has a disproportionate impact on how we learn Gemara, disproportionate meaning that it looks as if Rashi gets first say because Rashi's Rashi, but in his day, Ashkenaz Jewry was like a tiny fraction of Sephardic Jewry in terms of quantity and quality. But Rashi did what he did, so he gets pride of place always. So Rashi was a student like that from Rabbeinu Gershom and the early of the Ashkenazi tradition, which diverged from like the Rabbeinu Hananel, Rumi Gash, Rambam, down the Ramban and Rajba, and so side of the on the Sephardim. And they didn't really have communication at all. So very, very little communication. So you see only in times of Tosfos, like the 13th to 4th century, they try to reconcile like Rambam, Rabbeinu Hananel and so with the Sephardic with the tradition of the Ashkenazim. In any case, they went on for 500 years. That's the Rishonim period, called 1038. It's around 1500. Oh, we call it 1000 to 1500 to be really round and easy. In the year 1500 is a watershed point. What happened was in 1454, the printing press came to be. Which was a big game changer, of course, with scholarship. 1454. I always said 1453, but I was in Harvard last month, and they had the Gutenberg Bible there off the press, and they did it 1454, so I'll refer to them. I think maybe, I've been to Mainz also, where the Gutenberg Press is. I think they said 1453 over there, so I don't know what the locus is, but anyways. So that is a watershed. That, of course, didn't change Jewish scholarship. But what happened is that around the late 1400s comes the Shulchan Aruch to the fore. Okay, Rabbi Yosef Karo, another story from that time, writes the Shulchan Aruch, and because it does something very special, and the Rama, who's the leader of Ashkenazi Jewry, doesn't fight with it, but it sort of endorses it, just sort of supplements it. So you have one text that kind of covers the Sephardic and Ashkenazi traditions together, and you have a printing press to disseminate it. So that was a game changer. So that was the year like called 1500. After that, individual opinions of Rishonim are over and it becomes Achronim. I don't know when Achronim ends, but that last 500 years or so were the Achronim period. So that's the big gadol, the big picture in terms of the Jewish intellectual history. We're over time. I didn't get it what I wanted to do. Okay, fine. It's important. Let me just, our time's up. Let me just sum up in 30 seconds and take a picture of what I told you. Yeah. 1,000 years of Nebuah from the year, let's call it whatever. 1,000 years of Nebuah. Then there's 500 years of bias. Reach on time, the last 200 from the cold 0 to 200 is Tanaim. Then from say 200 to 500, 200 to 500 is Amoraim. 500 to 1,000, call it, is Gaonim. 1,000 to 1,500 is Rishonim. And 1,500, let's say to the present, is Achronim. Okay. Take one picture and then more tomorrow. Stay for your picture. You'll want it in 5 years' time, Bezer Hashem. Three. That's it. 3, 2. Oh, wait a minute. Don't worry.
Okay, I'm standing.
So you can hold me. 3, 2, 1. Nice. There you go. Okay.
Whatever tradition Rashi has, it's not like it was coming from like another
right.
So why is it so different?
Why
is it so different?
The Rambam says, I'm not arguing the Rif except in a handful of places. The Rif is like, but actually, the Rambam is a breakaway.
I don't know.
You want to compare the bubble to the black
They
developed two different streams. They developed approaches and many algum separated over time. You know, different world experience. And also,
the Byzantine period is
different approaches.
Once you take a approach to learning, polytonal has a different kind of approach to learning. Always say,
Gemara is not about the text itself at all, so that wouldn't make a change in it.
Well, rabbis aren't worried.
The way Rashi learns it is nothing's written down. Memorization takes a lot of effort. I then said nowadays the Mishnah is written down. The content is there in the books. Maybe much less is forgotten. Maybe Gemara again.
Just accept him and you're good to go.
Presumably, it's still around.
Oh, there you are.
Right. So